Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Hi, this is Dick Staub, and I want to welcome you to our morning meditation at Kindling's Fest 2011. Our meditations this year were led by Michael Card.
I want to start out with a warning. For me, this is an incredible place to be. I'm an affirmation junkie, and I want you guys to like me so much. I'm not, No, that's exactly what you don't need to do. I mean, this is a club that I've wanted to be in for a long, long time. And I really do. I'm warning you. I'm warning you. I've always sort of been an outsider. I've never really been in the music group. I mean, I grew up in Nashville around great musicians, but I never really fit into that group because they were always, they love music more than I do, frankly. I think music's okay, but I can sort of take it or leave it. I always wanted to be in the scholar group with Bill Lane, and I never got into that group. So I've always been this outsider. And really, just to be the time we've been here, you know, it's just, I mean, there's so many really cool people here. I mean, Eric, gosh. No, don't shake your head. You're cool. You are so cool. And, I mean, you need to be stopped, but you're cool. It used to be, you know, those of us who write rare books, are you with me, Jerry? Are you with me on this? Those of us who write rare books, we always sort of look down our noses at bestsellers because they're usually not very good books, right? But we'd all this rationale for why, you know, our books don't sell, why our books are rare, excuse me. And then Eric, you write the you know, for me, especially the Bonhoeffer book. I've read your other books and I love them, but you gave Bonhoeffer back to me, and that I'll never be able to thank you enough for that, because I mean, Bonhoeffer just meant so much to me. So, but you need to be stopped. So, and Lawrence, where's Lawrence? Maybe he's not here this morning. I mean, I want to be in your club so bad. I have painters. My mother was a painter. My big brother's a painter. And I have no visual intelligence, so I've never been in that club either. So, and I'm just warning you, I want to be in your club so bad, and I'm such an affirmation junkie. And so I'm warning you to listen really carefully this morning. And I believe, I hope, I trust that what I say is true. I've worked hard to try to make sure it's true, but it may be BS for all I know. I'm just warning you, I'm really good at this. I'm really good at this. So anything that I say that's not biblical, please let it fall to the ground. And, you know, let it simmer on the back burner of your mind. That's what I'm saying. I mean, you're laughing, but I'm not being humorous. Just beware. I believe that writers and thinkers and artists, God gives, I mean, he showers us with ideas, right? I believe that. He showers us with ideas. But in another sense, he gives you one or two really good ones in your life. You know, Brendan Manning's Healing Our Image of God, that's the idea that God gave him. And, you know, Bonhoeffer's When Jesus Calls a Man, He Bids Him Come and Die. I mean, Bonhoeffer had a lot of great ideas, but that was sort of that's what God gave him. Pascal, Every Man Must Lick the Earth. What a great idea. If you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with, Stephen Stills. So, you only get one of those in a lifetime. So what I want to share with you, I feel like this is my one. This is my big one. And so I want to share my big one with you. It has to do with lament, and I hope it fits in with this morning to dancing. So follow this idea with me, because this is the idea right here. If you hear nothing else, hear this next 30 seconds or whatever. So let's go slowly. It's a self-evident truth, which is also good. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident. That's a good thing. So follow along with me. The fall happened before the flood. Okay? The fall happened before the flood. Good. Be careful with the affirmation. So, Adam and Eve were cast out before it ever rained, right? Never rained until the flood. Good with me so far? So, teardrops are older than raindrops. Think about it. Teardrops are older, more fundamental, predate, whatever you want to say. Weeping is older than raining. That's a big idea. For those of us that are always trying to shut people up who are crying, you know, beginning with babies, right? We always try to staunch tears. But if you think of it, weeping is the first thing you do to show that you're alive, right? So it's fundamental to who we are, and tears are a good thing. And I've written two books on lament and one album on lament, so I've been meditating for this a long time. I told you yesterday, I had a lot of death around me. My sister lost two infants in 13 months. One was born with multiple birth defects. In fact, every birth defect a baby can have, this little boy had open spine, hydrocephalic, blind, you know, all kinds of birth defects. And he lived for 2 months and then died. And I was in Bible school then, and I was the Bible. I believe that the Bible is basically the answer book. I don't believe that so much anymore. And so the family came to me, and it was make perfect sense to me. God was showing us his mercy and took this little baby to be home with him. That made perfect sense. And 13 months later, my sister had another baby, another little boy, and he was perfect. And that made perfect sense. God has granted us this child, and it all made perfect sense. 2 months later, that little baby died of a ruptured appendix. And it made no sense to me. That made no sense to me. And that's when I began this quest. I told you my brother's 18-year-old son died of cancer, contracted it when he was 14, and was basically tortured by the medical profession for 4 years, and died well. Bill, I was with Bill all through his multiple myeloma, and that was tough. I mean, and I can go on and on, and so can you, right? Denny Denson died of pancreatic cancer. And there's something, isn't it interesting that we're still so shocked when death happens? You know, a 90-year-old lady dies, and you go, there's something in you that sort of revolts against that, because that's not what we're created for. We weren't created for this. We were created to wake up in a garden every morning, and we wake up in a death-impregnated, groaning world. I mean, even as beautiful as this is it fallen. You know, you're talking about the wonderful, I love that, your image of the braided ephraim of Saturn. What a beautiful, but that's the fallen world. Imagine what the unfallen one, or the redeemed one is going to be like. So weeping is older, teardrops are older than raindrops. So that's a self-evident truth. Let me give you one more self-evident truth that I'm pretty excited about. And that's this, is that the Bible is taking us somewhere. Did you feel that when I said those words? Did something resonate in you? The Bible is taking us somewhere. We're going somewhere. It's a journey. Whew, something in me resonates. When Jeff let the bell speak, I was reminded of Bill's favorite image. Bill used to take two C tuning forks, and he would bang one on the table and hold it next to the one he didn't bang, and it would begin to resonate. It's sympathetic resonance. It's a physics principle. But Bill would say, hearts are like that. Hearts are like that, right? You know, Jerry spoke yesterday morning, and my heart did this. And I hear these self-evident truths. There's something in me that resonates. So let's think about this idea that teardrops are older than raindrops, and that the Bible is taking us somewhere. Okay, that's my idea for the morning. If I had a chalkboard, and I really like chalkboards or wipe-off boards because it lets me know what I've said, what I haven't said. It's really more for me than anybody in the class. But so pretend there's a, you know, you have good imagination, so most of you. That was a joke. Pretend there's a wipe-off board here, and I'm going to draw a line. Okay, and over here is the beginning of the journey. And under at the end of this line, I'd write Genesis 1. Right, and I go down here, and I write Revelation 22. From Genesis to Revelation's journey. And I come back over here, and I'd Psalm 1. Psalm 150. And then, Job 1, Job 42. It's a journey. The journey always begins with Torah, with the law, with that formula, that beautiful formula. I was raised in Southern Baptist, and we were sort of mildly anti-law. Right? We were easy grace. I mean, that's one reason Bonhoeffer was so great for me. Easy grace was the perfect solution for my sickness, because Southern Baptist, no offense if you're Southern Baptist. I reckon there's probably not very many of them up here, though. Any Southern Baptists here? Yeah, see, there you go. But easy grace is our thing. And Bonhoeffer says, you know, how could you make something cheap that costs God everything? So we sort of grew up mildly anti-law, but I've really come to realize, no, the law is a good thing. The law is a good thing. It's based on this formula. The formula is if I'm obedient, God will bless me. If I'm disobedient, God will punish me. That's the formula. And it's good. And I didn't understand how good it was until I realized that that is the beginning of the journey. It's only good when you understand that that's where your journey begins. So my daughter, I have a 22-year-old daughter, Katie, just got married. She's a dancer, very tall and elegant, and she's incredible, my daughter. But when she was little, I tell her to clean up her room. I say, Katie, you clean up your room, I'll give you an M&M. If you don't, though, I'm going to whack you. Right? That's Torah, right? If you're obedient, I'm going to bless you. If you're disobedient, I'm going to punish you. That's the law. And it's a wonderful place to begin the journey. But what would it be like if Katie came to visit us with her new husband, who I also think is awesome. Whew, thank goodness. What would it be like if I said, honey, you clean up your room, Daddy's going to give you an M&M, but if not, Daddy's going to spank. That'd be kind of sick, wouldn't it? Why would that be sick? It's because Katie and I, we're on a journey together that began with Torah, but it's moving towards intimacy. And that's the journey the Bible has us on. It just begins with the law. But you and I are being led, if we'll go on it, on this journey to an intimacy that we cannot imagine. Job, you see it in Job 1, right? Job is the guy who offers sacrifices for sins his children might have committed. He's a law guy. And it had always worked for him until chapter 2. And the equation didn't quite work, did it? But Job goes on this journey. So by 41, Job says, man, my ears had heard about you, but now my eyes see you. That's the journey we're all on. You know, we begin with the Torah in the Old Testament, Revelation 21. You know, I heard a loud voice from the throne say, at last the dwelling of God is with men and women, and He will live with them. The deepest desire of God is to be with you. That's what holds Scripture together. That's what the law is for. What do you get if you keep the law? Leviticus 22:12. I'll walk with them and be their God, and they'll be my people. That's what the law is for. That's what the tabernacle was for. It's what the temple was for. It's what the incarnation's for. What's His incarnation name? Emmanuel, God with us. What are practically the last words from His lips? Behold, I am with you. And the climax of the whole Scripture is in 21, when this loud voice says, at last, the dwelling of God is with men and women. He will live with them. They will be His people. He'll wipe away every tear. Those fundamental tears that are so basic to our experience in this death-impregnated fallen world. And as I understand the Greek, or as it's been explained to me, it's not like He's wiping them out with a tissue. It's like a sheriff who wipes out crime. He's going to wipe out tears, y'all. So that's the journey. That's the journey we're on. Same thing in the Psalms. Psalm 1, what is Psalm 1? It's a barokah to people who keep the law. Blessed, barukata, blessed is the guy who keeps the law. What's Psalm 150? It's this riotous sort of wah praise. In fact, the last several psalms are praise, celebrations of intimacy. That's the journey. Okay? Now, is that self-evident? All right? That's self-evident. Nobody can disagree to that. That's the good news. Here's the rest of the story, though. If I have my line here. The great central section of that journey is wilderness. It's wilderness. But it's only in the wilderness that we learn what God is worth. Last thing God says to Pharaoh through Moses in Exodus, let my people go so that they can worship me in the wilderness. Mourning to dancing. You learn to dance in the wilderness. You don't learn to dance here. You've got to learn the steps in the wilderness. So what Job, what happens? He finds out all of his children have been killed in this storm where a wind blows in from four directions at one time. What was that? And the first thing the book says is Job, when he found out, he fell down and worshiped. See, what is worship? Worship is learning the worth of God, celebrating the worth of God. And if that's true, then all worship begins in the wilderness. Because that's where we find out what God is worth. Israel goes into the wilderness when they're hungry. What does he give them? Manna. What's this? I love manna. That's untranslatable. I love untranslatable words. Manna. When they're thirsty, the rock that is Christ is struck living water. When their enemies threaten them, God says, stand still and just watch this. So in the wilderness, they learn what God is worth so they can worship him. And the same is true for us. God calls us into the wilderness as the Spirit drove Jesus into the wilderness after his baptism. And it's there that he establishes us as his sons and daughters. So if I'm here to promote anything, I'm here to promote the idea of don't move too quickly into the dancing part. In fact, I could probably make a pretty strong case for the rest of our lives are going to be spent in the wilderness. I mean, ultimately, the real dancing doesn't come until, the horn we hear that strikes, whatever that last chord is going to be. I'd like to hear that one. I hope to hear that one soon. Okay. We learn what worship, we learn the worth of God in the wilderness. When the dancers were dancing yesterday, I have no visual intelligence whatsoever, but I got it yesterday. But what I realized was, once again, I want to warn you, I think that you dancers, what you can do for us is simply remind us that dancing is possible. I think that's, I mean, I would like to say that anyway. You've thought about this more than I have, and that's your field. I'm not going to pretend to tell a dancer. But there's no bypass. You don't get around this wilderness. It's a lesson that you are going to learn. And it's one of the great mercies, great ways that God shows us how much he loves us. And it's a journey that we do together, isn't it? We go through the wilderness together. Isn't that that's a good thing? You are not alone. I hear God almost every page of the scripture, he's reminding us that we're not alone in this journey. But at the same time, you really are alone in another sense. So we do it together. We do it alone. But the point is, God loves you so much, he'd rather die than live without you. That's another one of Brendan's great ideas. He loves you so much, he'd rather die than live without you. He loves you so much, he wants to be married to you, and he is committed to making this journey with you. So that's basically it. That's my idea. That's my self-evident truth. That we're called into the wilderness to learn what God is worth. And we can't dance until we learn the steps. And we learn the steps in the wilderness. God doesn't waste anything. He doesn't waste a single tear. He writes them down in a book. He collects them in a bottle. He's the God of the bottle and the book. He doesn't waste anything. In fact, let me, in closing, pitch me that book there, would you, my brother? I can't slip across this red line, I'm told. Something terrible might happen. My hair might fall out or something. In closing, just let me read you this little essay, and then we'll just be quiet for a little while. Is that good? Is that cool? Psalm 56:8, you put my tears in your bottle. Just this morning, my youngest daughter, Maggie, came to me cradling a twisted strip of pink plastic in her hands. She found it in the bottom of a large box in the attic marked Maggie. What is this? She asked. As I looked at it more closely, I read the small stamped letters, card, baby girl. A flood of memories rushed over me when I realized it was the bracelet the nurse in the delivery room had placed around her wrist the moment she was born. I explained what it was, remembering for her in as much detail as I could muster up, what it was like for me to see her small face for the first time, to be the first person to hold her. But I began to notice that my teary remembrances didn't seem to resonate with her heart in the least. She kept turning the bracelet over and over in her small hands. She looked up and whispered, "Mom, save this." It wasn't my paternal moment from 13 years ago that captured her imagination. It was the fact that her mother had cared enough to save even this tiny scrap of her past, to value it as a treasured keepsake. Psalm 56:8 speaks of a God who treasures away such keepsakes. The verse contains a word which translators seem fairly evenly divided on. It's the Hebrew word node. This is one of those incidences in which, once you understand the background, you can make a choice for yourself as well as the scholars. Scholars hate it when I say that. Node is from a certain root word that has something to do with skin. So here are your choices. First, it can be translated scroll, since scrolls were made from animal skins. The problem is a couple of other words are used to designate scroll in the Old Testament. And I go off into this. You wouldn't be interested in this discussion. Let me skip down. The second choice is to see the word as referring to a wineskin or flask. Node occurs twice in the Old Testament with this meaning. I give all the references and launch off into a meaningless discussion of that. Also in support of this translation are thousands of tiny long-necked bottles archaeologists have unearthed all over Israel called lacrimantaries, or tear bottles. Supporters of the second translation point to these as the best central support for their position. Inside the first scroll camp, the camp of people who believe it means scroll, they say these bottles are merely for expensive perfume. This is just a tiny window into the confusing world of being a Bible translator. They argue about this stuff endlessly. Either way, the text is saying that our tears are of great value to God. He takes the time to record each one on a scroll or in a book, or else he treasures them enough to collect them in a tiny bottle as precious as perfume. I confess, I tend to gravitate toward the second choice. I like the notion that God has a bottle and a book. They make a great lyric. An infinitely compassionate meteorologist, he collects and records our tears, measuring and recording our tearfall. Get it? When you step back and look at the psalm, you might be surprised to discover that this is one of the warrior psalms of David, sung to the long-lost tune of A Dove on Distant Oaks. We don't have that anymore, so we have to have Jeff give us good new tunes. In this psalm, David is lamenting to God about the battle he's having with his numerous enemies, both within his kingdom and without. They plot and conspire and twist his words. David has had all he can stand and cries out for mercy, for hesed. It is Israel's fearless warrior king who pleads with God, but he is a weeping warrior. In the midst of the turmoil, he finds comfort in the image of the God who bends to compassionately collect his tears in a flask and make note of them in his special book. But this, I believe, is not the main source of comfort and encouragement David finds in singing the song of the God of the bottle in the book. The key is a twice repeated phrase in verses 4 and verses 11. David writes, "I'm not afraid. What can mere mortals do to me?" It is a phrase that echoes in the New Testament in the benediction of Hebrews 13:6. If you listen carefully, you can detect that the tone is more a matter of simple childlike trust than a complicated grown-up theology. It is a confidence rooted in the memory of the little boy who once stood before an unconquerable giant with only 5 smooth stones in his pocket. On that long ago battlefield, God taught David that mere mortals, indeed, could not harm him. Now, in the midst of yet another long line of battles, he turns over in his mind again and again the image of the leather lacrimantery, and amazed, reaches out through lament to the God who cares deeply enough to make a keepsake of a collection of his tears. And now go in the name of the God of the bottle and the book. Go in the name of the God who is committed to be with us on the journey. Go and use that knowledge of His worth, use your tears, every single one of them, to paint and sing and dance and sculpt and create. In the assurance that only He is worthy to receive those things that hurt us the most. Go in the name of the God who uses suffering to save the world.
Hi, this is Dick Staub, and I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Kindlings Muse at Kindlings Fest. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more, just visit thekindlings.com and become an associate. As an associate, you'll enjoy complete access to the vast archives of the Kindlings. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time on the Kindlings Muse.